Are we the snowflake generation? Is romance dead? Is social media turning our brains to mush? Is chivalry sexist? Welcome to 20s Questions. Join me, Francesca McClement, as I set out to talk to young people from different countries, continents, and backgrounds about what it's like to be a young person in this day and age.
This week, I'm super excited to welcome Josh Tullock. Welcome, Josh.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. So Josh graduated from Oxford University in 2019, and in my opinion, has honestly done some amazing things. Josh, please talk to me about some of the things you did at Oxford, because, yeah, they're amazing.
So at Oxford, I studied philosophy, politics, and economics. And in terms of stuff I did outside of my degree, I was vice president of the Oxford ACS. So we were in charge of creating a space for African and Caribbean students within Oxford, where they could feel safe, where they could celebrate their culture, and also where we could promote Afro-Caribbean culture via cultural events, conferences, access events, and cultural exhibits. So one of the big things that we used to run was the annual Access Conference, which was aimed at sixth form students of African and Caribbean descent. And we would get, you know, over 100 students from state schools in London and around the UK, and basically just dispel myths about Oxford to them. And what we found was that, you know, people weren't really worried about grades or the workload or anything like that. It was all cultural questions. It was, you know, where can I get my hair done? Where can I buy food that I like? What, you know, are the people, am I going to fit in with the people that go there? Is it all posh kids? So, you know, answering really basic questions like that, you know, I went to their conferences when I was in sixth form, and just having those basic questions answered was the key to me applying. Apart from that, I was involved in student government in my college in LMH, and we did a kind of
LMH is
Lady
Margaret Hall, by the way, just so people know.
Sorry, Lady Margaret Hall. We did a bunch of stuff. And one of the big things was constitutional reform, which is a bit boring, so we won't get into that. I was involved in a whole load of things.
And you started a food bank.
Yeah. So we started, not quite a food bank, but we started a initiative after I graduated that would get food into food banks. So it's an organization called Because We Can. And the basic premise of it, like the name says, is, look, if we're able to, and it's possible to, and we've got the time to and the capacity to, then why not do something to help with food poverty within the UK, which is absolutely skyrocketing before the pandemic, and now the pandemic has made it so many times worse. And basically put together a competition between Oxford and Cambridge to see who could donate the most amount of food, and that ran last Christmas.
Yeah, so that was called the Great Oxbridge Bog Off, right?
Yeah.
And is it stopped now? So did it finish in December?
Yeah, it finished in December. And just so your listeners are aware, the bog off means buy one, give one free. And the idea was that we encourage students to, when they are going shopping and they see something that they might be buying that's also needed by the food bank, that they would buy one for themselves and then buy one and give it for free to the food bank. And yeah, it did stop in Christmas. The plan was to expand it to other universities in London, but then lockdown happened, so university campuses closed, and now they're only opening up again once lectures are finished, so there isn't really a point in students going onto campus. So unfortunately, we've had to kind of pause everything until next term, so hopefully we'll be able to do the Oxbridge one again in the Christmas time, and then expand it to London afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, UNICEF now has intervened with the food poverty problem in the UK, haven't they?
They have, yeah. It's really gotten to that point. It's something that was under the radar for so long because of government cuts to benefits and general rising levels of poverty due to insecure housing, due to insecure jobs, people throughout society. And one of the most worrying statistics is the fact that it's most of these people are ones that have jobs already, so the employment that they've got isn't enough to sustain them. So this is something that has been a problem for a long time, and the pandemic has just made it worse, like it's done with a lot of social problems.
That's awful. So even a salary can't cover basic needs like food.
Yeah. So when, you know, the government comes onto the news and talks about rising employment figures and how more people are in work than ever before, it really hides the reality of what kind of work they're getting and whether this work is actually able to sustain them and sustain their families.
People, I'm assuming you'd think that they're not getting enough support from the government, because otherwise they wouldn't be in this situation or being forced to go to food banks.
Yeah, I think that fundamentally something is very broken if in one of the richest countries in the world, you've got a situation where a significant portion of your whole population is food insecure or in food poverty, where many of these households have children in them who should not be experiencing. Like, we saw the debate over free school meals going on, and we saw that the government had to be shamed by Marcus Rashford into providing free school meals. And the fact that that was even something that was necessary,
yeah,
is heartbreaking enough. But then when confronted with the issue, when the ignorance is taken away, the government, you know, wanted to turn a blind eye until people stepped up and various community initiatives came about to feed them. And then the government U-turned.
They're good at U-turning.
They are. And it usually takes them a while. And this one was shamefully long, how long it took the national campaign to get them right on track.
I think something, like you said, is fundamentally wrong if it takes a footballer to use his own personal experiences and struggles in life to say, this is not right, we have to change. And for the government, like for the prime minister, to then call him and apologise, it's just not proper governance, really, is it?
No. And, you know, the government's job is to be aware of these sorts of issues and hopefully to reduce these sorts of issues, whether it be through more stable employment or direct help through benefits and social programs. But the fact is that they flat out refuse to. And the government, you know, this the same party that presided over the cuts is the same party in power now. So there isn't really the political will to kind of admit that your policies have led to some of the issues that are going on now. And it's a shame that, you know, we have to rely on the kindness of the rich. And I'm not, you know, bashing Marcus Rashford, or, I mean, what he's doing is incredible. But if we look at, you know, charitable initiatives and philanthropy in general, we're relying on, you know, on the off chance that, you know, somebody rich is feeling nice and they will bring attention to our cause. And for me, that's like, that doesn't really feel like a sustainable way of doing things.
Yeah, and also the motivations for him to intervene was from his own personal experiences. So if it's the rich that haven't experienced such things, they would be less inclined because they don't have a personal motivation. So yeah, no, for sure it's a tough one. And you're, in terms of personal motivations, what personally motivated you to start Because We Can? Like, did it come from your own personal experiences?
Yeah, I experienced something similar to what Rashford went through, which was food insecurity. And when I was younger, for a period of time, my family was homeless, and we were, you know, couch surfing, so essentially, we'd try and find friends who had a spare room or had space in their house, and we'd either, you know, we'd be sleeping, you know, me, my brother and my mum sleeping top to tail on like double beds in small spare rooms wherever we could find them. And that happened over the course of a period of months until the council and the government, you know, government services, once we needed them, stepped in and they found temporary housing. And that social safety net I was able to find, and you know, there wasn't ever a time when I went hungry, because there were times when we didn't know where food would come from, and then, you know, a friend would pop up with a big dish of lasagna or somebody would pop up with something else, or like a church group would give us something, or charity would be able to give us something. But even when I was recalling those experiences, I remember times when my mum actually wouldn't eat at the table. And I remember seeing Rashford's mum's interview, and she was saying, yeah, there were times that she wouldn't eat to make sure that her kids would eat. And I remember times, and I'd never thought of it like that, because when you're a kid, if your mum says, you know, I'm not hungry, I just took her face value, like, okay, cool, she's not hungry, let me eat my food. And I just had no idea that what she was doing was making sure that we could eat for that evening, and she was going without. So that person experience, knowing that we relied heavily on the kindness of strangers, we relied on people who, you know, were just willing to help. And because, again, it just comes down to because they could, you know, they saw something needed to be done and they did it. So as soon as, you know, I'm confronted with that sort of issue, I wanted to do my bit. So, I mean, really, this all began in high school when I started the food drive in my own school. And we did what we called the Ton of Love Challenge, where we tried to get a ton of food donated to food banks. And then, you know, people actually smashed it out of the water. We managed to get 1.7 tons. And then the next year we went for 2 tons and we managed to get 3 tons. And then it's kind of carried on at the school, and literally tons of food has been donated to local food banks. And then bringing it to Oxford and Cambridge, I thought, you know, a better platform would be universities, where students have disposable income, they've got energy, they want to help. It was a great success.
That's amazing. Yeah, I definitely think at universities like Oxford and Cambridge as well, even from like a minority of students, you could probably get them to really buy extra. No, for sure. And I mean, it must give you a really great sense of like sort of satisfaction that you used your position at university for good, and you made other people use it as well, when a lot of those students probably didn't even think about it, or didn't even consider the problem, or the way that they could contribute to improving it.
Yeah, for me, Oxford was never kind of the end goal in a way. It was always a stepping stone to make sure that ensuring that I could use my life in a way that would help others. Because, you know, once you've got a name like Oxford on your CV, or that's something that is part of the conversation, it opens doors. And, you know, it's a shame that that is the case, that it's necessary to be taken seriously. You have to go to these very serious institutions. I could never, you know, be satisfied with going into a university like that, being imbued with that much privilege as soon as you've got that label, and not using it in some way to help, or at least do something about problems that I myself have experienced and problems that I haven't experienced, and hopefully as I grow older there'll be other things that I get involved in.
No, definitely. And did you always know that you wanted to go to Oxford? Was that sort of always somewhere you saw yourself fitting in, or?
Not really. My first interaction with Oxbridge as a concept was year 10. My school had organised, well, Oxford had organised a talk for the local schools in my borough.
You're from South London, right?
South London, yeah. So I went to a state school in South London. I'm not sure if people know Dulwich College. So Dulwich College is the private school where Nigel Farage went.
Great legacy.
Yeah. So we were the state school next to Dulwich College.
Okay.
So we were like the kind of the bad state school, and things were going wrong, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, they'd never, ever sent anyone to Oxbridge before. And they were having a talk in the local, in a local school. And I went to the office to get a letter for the trip, because I thought all my friends were going. So I thought, you know, I don't want to go home. I'll just go with them. And then one of the teachers just looked at me like thrown something at him, because he just looked at me like, who are you? Like, what do you think you're doing trying to get this letter? And then a maths teacher turned around and said, you know, if the man wants to go, let him go. And then got me a letter and gave it to me. And then it was that kind of act, because at that time I was a very average student. I was getting what would have been the equivalent of like C's and B's and D's. And it really did take teachers looking at me and believing in me and saying, no, you just need to work hard. You just need to focus. And then from then on, it was kind of like Oxbridge or nothing sort of thing. So it switched pretty quickly, and all it took was like that little bit of belief. So I was actually along with another girl, we were the first from our school to ever get into Oxbridge. And then from there, it's seen a pretty steady trickle of people going, because they're kind of more used to the process.
You opened the market.
Yeah. I mean, it was the happenstance of me getting in, and then as soon as they knew how the system worked, they knew how to kind of get people along after that. So it's been good to see that they've been able to get that done.
And when you were at Oxford, how did you, especially being vice president of the association you were for Caribbean and African students,
also as a black student,
with all the controversy around the Cecil Rhodes statue on Oriel College?
Oriel College, yeah.
Yeah. How did you feel about it? Did you find it sort of like looking over you in a negative way? I'm not wording this well, but.
No, I understand. I think I'm in two minds about the statue. I think that what the statue represents is obviously a man who is not only reviled today, but was also reviled in his time. Like, you can find this idea that Cecil Rhodes, he has only now been judged by history and found to be wanting, is ridiculous. And the idea that he's being cancelled, I mean, he was cancelled back in the day. There were articles that talked about his atrocities, and, you know, this man was not liked or beloved in Britain. He was seen as a monster. And now he's been able to kind of whitewash his name.
But he donated loads of money to Oriel College, so it's fine.
That's the thing. That's how people tend to get away with these things. They donate to culture and higher institutions, and suddenly you can't say anything about them. The reason I'm in two minds about it is because, as a symbol, yes, it symbolizes something wrong. On the other hand, symbolic victories are really hard won. And once you've won a symbolic victory, it's very difficult to get structural victories. So, you know, let's say that we win the battle to get Cecil Rhodes' statue down. But really, you know, is our energies better directed at getting more Black and African students into, or deprived students, no matter their race, into Oxford and Cambridge? Is our energies better directed at, you know, decolonizing the curriculum and making sure that there's more diverse perspectives? This is why I'm very much not on the fence, but I'm not sure that once you get or you achieve this victory, you've achieved anything beyond an aesthetic change to a college, which is the removal of a statue. So I think, yeah, it's a worthy cause, but I prefer to, at least personally, to focus on more wide-ranging structural process-driven change. And I'm just not sure that, and maybe it's a misunderstanding on my part. Maybe I've not fully read.
He had a weird legacy though, because when I researched him for a presentation I did at uni, he obviously did all those awful things in South Africa, but then, as well as donating money to the college, on top of that, he founded like a diversity student fund, and it was like a fund to support students that otherwise wouldn't have access to the college, and it was like minority ethnic students as well, so to give them money to study. And I was like, I don't understand how that fits in with what he was simultaneously doing in his work camps in South Africa. Like,
yeah, it's weird. It is very weird, but you'll find examples of this, of kind of people with a colonial attitude or who have participated in colonial atrocities, able to, in one hand, capable of the most cruel things, but on the other hand, they are being kind to, let's say, their black neighbor or the person that they've got employed in their house or the slave in their house. Like, you had, like, even in times of slavery, you had the distinction between the field slaves and the house slaves, where kindness was given to the house slaves, and sometimes house slaves would get the master's property, would get adopted into the family, and you've got all of these kind things that they do. versus the atrocities that are being, you know, carried out against other people. So I think it's perfectly possible to do these two things at the same time. But yeah, I think he's managed, or at least his, not maybe not his family, but he has managed to, with the Rhodes Scholarship, kind of push the conversation of his legacy towards that other side rather than...
It complicates the matter, because there was the debate then, if you take the statue down, should we get rid of his fund for, yeah, students that don't normally have access to institutions like Oxford?
Yeah, it's a very difficult one. And I think that's why these sorts of strategies are employed by people like him, where as soon as you've... It's very clever, because as soon as you've got your hands in things that are public goods that people, you know, very much agree are good, like art galleries or, you know, funding arts or education, etc., it's very difficult to kind of disentangle that from the other stuff you're doing. So yeah, it's a topic on which I myself, I'm not sure what my view is, because there are so many strategies for trying to wrestle back power from people with legacies like that.
Yeah, I know that this is a bit more general, and you said you're not completely sure on the topic, but taking down statues of questionable figures in general around the UK, because there are so many, it's not just Cecil Rhodes, do you think it's a way of just eradicating negative parts of history that we don't like? Or do you think that they should just be moved to like a museum, for example?
It's, again, a very difficult one, because... British history is so wrapped up in, the empire really only stopped existing properly in the 70s, and you can even argue that it still exists in a form or another via the Commonwealth. So it's very difficult to even, you know, disentangle, you know, a statue of Queen Victoria. What do you do with that? You know, that was a monarch, that was a sovereign, but, you know, Empress of India. So, like,
Churchill, now with his legacy as well, that's, the conversation is changing all the time.
I think it's possible. One suggestion from a historian, I forget his name, it's David something, he suggested contextualize these statues, make sure that there is no more ambiguity as to what they were doing. So for example, the Colston statue in Bristol, the description on the statue simply read that he was, you know, an entrepreneur and a trader. And it's like, okay, what did he trade? He traded human lives. Like, let's be very explicit about what we're doing. And if these statues are meant to glorify people, and it turns out these people, you know, managed to get those statues by buying their way in via the proceeds of the heinous crimes that they've committed, then yeah, let's put them in a museum. If it requires contextualization, if it's not, you know, it's very hard to rank these things, but if it's not so clear cut as to whether we should honor them or not, like in the case of a sovereign or a leader, then perhaps it is good enough just to say, look, did this, but also did this. I find it very difficult when, or at least I find it to be hypocritical when people who disagree with the contextualization of statues and tend to be the people who talk about political correctness in history. And there's nothing to be more politically correct than a whitewashed version of history where all of your national leaders did no wrong and they were patriots and they were amazing people. That seems to me to be politically correct, because you are trying not to offend the sensibilities of the nation. Whereas true honesty and a true reckoning with what has been going on is a way that actually it's been shown to work and defeat extremism, and having a honest conversation about our history is something that needs to happen.
It's so much better to know from a young age, like have everything, all the cards on the table and know everything, rather than like I feel like I'm finding out more things that are just really disappointing as I get older, and I'm like, I would rather have known all the atrocities at a younger age, and rather than like every day, every week, finding out something that just makes you sort of disappointed in the country that you were born and raised in. That's how I feel anyway.
Yeah, and it's something that the education system doesn't do. You'll learn about the atrocities, but it's funny how you know, in history, you'll learn in great detail the horrors of the American racial segregation system. But not one word will be told about the 300 years of apartheid, imperialism, slavery, genocide, etc., that went under British rule. And I remember that, being, you know, in primary school, you're taught the history of the British Empire, and all they say is, we ruled a third of the world. Everyone goes, yeah, Britain. And then I remember feeling quite pride of that.
Yeah, yeah, like the sun never sets on the British Empire, woo!
Exactly.
Oh, God, yeah.
And then reading horrible histories about the British Empire, and I was outraged. I was like, what have we been taught? I think that would be the first step. Everyone needs to read the Horrible Histories edition on the British Empire, and then then see what your thoughts are on whether we should be proud of it or not.
I'm glad to hear that you're a Horrible Histories fan. My friend Chelsea, she would watch it all the time in Padua. She'll be really happy to hear that you're a fan of Horrible Histories.
It's nice. It's one of the greatest programs CBBC's ever created. It's just, it's informative, it's funny, it's clever, it's just, it's everything.
What do you think is the best and worst thing about being a young person at the moment?
Pandemic aside, I would say that the strangest thing about being this age, where you've just left university, is everything up until now has been very structured and very ordered, and the instruction manual has been very clear. It's, you know, year six, you do your SATs. The SATs lead to GCSEs. The GCSEs lead to A-levels. The A-levels lead to your degree. And then there's not really much after that. It's kind of like, okay, degree's done, go out into the world. And you are both without kind of actual productive purpose, because without a job, let's say, you have to decide what you want to do. And then you're without social structures as well, because within universities, and this is something I found much more difficult, was that without social structures where, like, for example, in Oxford, you could just start a society and bell up a few of your mates, or just post in a group, and within a week, a Facebook page has been set up, there's a society, you're doing a thing, versus real life where it's like, there's not really a community of people just willing to kind of do things.
Yeah.
On the spur of the moment, or just like get things done, and it's certainly possible, but it's much more difficult. And I think being kind of the author of your own story, as it were, to speak in cliches, is very difficult, because you have to figure out what you're going to write, what's next. So I think it's the confusion of the lack of structure is kind of the worst thing, but also the best thing, because it's like once you figure it out, it's great.
Yeah, I find not knowing my next steps in life, it's unnerving, but also really exciting. And yeah, everyone should follow Because We Can on Facebook, the Facebook page. Where else can people find it as well to interact?
So you can find it on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, a website eventually. There's not really going to be much going on because we've had to pause it
In the autumn, though.
In the autumn, yeah, we're going to be starting back up. So yeah, find us on that, and yeah, hopefully we can get moving on the issue of food poverty again.
Yes, thank you so much, Josh.
No worries, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you for tuning into 20s Questions. If you're enjoying my chats with inspiring young people, please subscribe to this podcast on Spotify and Apple Music. You can also find it on my website, franthropology.com.